So is that board still like a piece of shit?
No, it's not.
There's one marker that works.
Yeah, the brown one's good.
Well, I mean, but it can erase shit,
yes,
right?
Yes, you can
I just erase something. Yeah.
But I mean, if I put it on for more than 2 minutes,
oh, well,
then
well, if you
one
were
of them
enough,
is
like,
Ryan,
cool.
Yeah, one of them is Brian.
Oh, boy.
So I asked her once.
I'm going to get the...
Okay, she goes deep. And she said, Bidoyan. I thought it means Bidoyan, but it means
Brian.
Brian.
That's funny. Oh, man.
Bidoyan.
Oh, man. Oh, there's an Indo-European book up there. Oh,
is there?
Yeah. Better steal it.
Let me see.
I'm going to follow along.
Oh.
Ancient Indo-European dialects.
Ooh. Okay.
Dialects of old
Indo-Iranian.
Boy. Well, I have a handout that we can talk about if you guys are like,
great,
you
want
to do that.
Great.
So it's like, Trevor says he's gonna be a little late, but I guess you know we're starting early anyway, so it's gonna be very, very late. There's one for me, one for John. Not my best handout because it's mostly just text because I don't want to talk about linguistics, so we're gonna talk about
archaeology
or whatever.
All right.
Ooh.
The Kurgan hypothesis.
Oh my god.
Is that, is that there can be only one?
Yeah. What do you mean?
He's been on the place with the crabs. Apparently he was like super, the actor's like the most polite guy ever. Like
yeah.
He apologized to everyone after all the scenes, but he was a dick.
Wait, who is this?
Oh,
the Kurgan.
The Kurgan.
Highlander.
I don't know this. I've never.
You've never seen the movie, or you don't know he's a nice guy.
You
gotta
see the movie, man.
Okay. It's all about that's what this is.
Oh.
It's like we should just cancel the meeting and watch the movie.
Watch the movie.
Equally as educational.
Damn, you should have made the handout. Shit, I'm way behind.
Like,
apparently,
there can be only one.
Yeah.
There's the gathering.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Connor McCloud, the Clam McCloud.
Yeah. Well.
I should drop that in the Gaelic meeting somewhere.
Was Sean Connery in that movie?
Yeah,
that's right.
He played. It was so they had what they had. The main Scottish guy was like Swiss.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had Sean Connery play an Egyptian.
Or a Spaniard.
Yeah,
yeah
he wasn't Scottish, but he had a better Scottish accent.
It was
Scottish
so funny.
Guy.
Yeah, yeah.
It
was really weird. I mean, we'll eventually talk about Indo-European, but I just gotta get this. I gotta get this off my chest.
Dude, we never talk about Indo-European.
This guy, like in the flashbacks, like he has a Scottish accent, and then in the present he has like this weird Swiss German thing going on.
So actually, I coincidentally in the past couple of days on TVTropes.com
yeah.
or whatever.
Oh,
I
love TV Tropes.
I've been on Highlander, and that was actually intentional by the actor. He was supposed to.
Yeah.
Christopher Lambert was trying to play a character who's trying to hide his accent.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because he has a relatively good Scottish accent.
Yeah,
then he has
yeah.
this kind of like...
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is no one but linguists thinks about shit like
yeah.
that. Everyone else just takes it at face value. So it's like, you know, lost on them.
But yeah, like in the present day, he's always like, hello, I am not Scottish.
Ich bin ein Highlander.
Exactly.
Oh,
Jesus. It's
yeah, it's actually just.
And
really
Queen
sweet.
Did the soundtrack.
Why have I never seen this?
How
you
gotta
know.
See this? It's like right up your alley.
It's like the most 80s movie ever.
All right.
Okay.
Check it out.
Is he coming?
Who? Oh.
Trevor. Is he coming? Is he coming? Oh my god.
If she didn't say yes.
Reduction. Reduction.
Yep.
Doesn't help.
The Iranian people.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, we're going to get to that. Don't look ahead. We're in the first page.
The Iranian
now.
People.
We haven't even started in the first line.
This is the truth.
So, Indo-European Ur-Haimat. I think that's how it's. Ur-Haimat. Whatever. I don't know how you pronounce it in English. It means the place of origin.
Yeah, Ur-Haimat.
And the time of origin. So I guess we sort of talked about this. So everyone in the field really thinks that Indo-European people basically come from the Pontic steppes. And yep. It's one of those, I mean, you know, this is like life lessons, guys. We know so little about history that, like, basically you can still make arguments for, like, an out-of-India theory. And all of the evidence against something like that is just, like, circumstantial. Or you could say that Indo-Europeans came from wherever you like, I don't know, London or something like that. And you can make circumstantial arguments, and really all of the reason we have particular theories is because they're consistent with what we see in archaeology, and because we know so little about history, like, everything is just a wash. So,
just a quick blurb on that. There was a paper that came out in, like, Science, on the Indo-European steppe hypothesis by Andrew Garrett and friends.
Mm-hmm.
He presented it at the LSA Summer Institute as well. And, like, they do, like, Bayesian cladistics or something like
Jesus.
That. But yeah, like, and I'm pretty sure that the idea was that it supports the steppe hypothesis.
If that's, I guess we'll talk about this in just a second. But there's another famous thing by Quentin Atkinson, which does, you know, Bayesian classical cladistics, shit like that. And they come in favor of the Anatolian hypothesis.
Uh-huh.
Of course, obviously I don't believe in statistics at all, and I think they're totally useless, especially with classifying languages, because what you inevitably do is you put in cognates, or you put in similar terms, and you run regressions, and you find similarities, but that's not actually how languages are related. And a lot of times our historical knowledge about these languages is very specific, so you can't necessarily, you can't replace that. Like, you know, things like the expansion of Italic languages, like the Roman conquest, you can't model that statistically or something like that. And all the things that do try and model that, model it as gradual migration, so it's consistent with everything else. So,
horse-riding patriarchal Indo-European shitlords.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to the shitlords. Okay, so early wrong theories. We're still at section 1.1. Section 1.1. So, obviously, when Indo-European shit comes out, so you guys all know about, like, William Jones, right?
Yeah,
so,
Billy Jones.
Yeah, Billy Jones. He's really just famous for this one quote that he has when he's, like, talking, when he presents at, this was back in 1780-something, where he's at the Asiatic Society of Bengal, and he's talking about, oh, well, look, Sanskrit is obviously related to not Indo-European languages, but Latin and Greek and all these other things, and it's so much, it's totally great, it's a great language, it's so complex. So after that, there's a very conscious connection of people sort of realize that all these languages are related. They don't realize it very well, so even Jones didn't understand that Hindi was actually related to Sanskrit. He thought it was like some other kind of language, but anyway, starting from there, no one had any clue where they came from. Jones himself thought they came from Persia. Most people sort of thought Indo-Europeans came out of India. And the reason for that, of course, just being that Sanskrit was the most archaic language. So there are a lot of respects in which, so we talked about the Indo-European vowel system, and at least in late Indo-European, you have, you know, all the, I drew you on the wrong side, okay, I was going to draw it anyway.
Yeah.
I totally forgot how to do linguistics, guys.
What is linguistics?
Yeah. So, you know, at least the late system, of course, we talked about how Indo-European might only have one, well, pre-Indo-European might only have one vowel, that's E. But late Proto-Indo-European clearly has all the 10 normal, quote-unquote, normal typological vowels. So Sanskrit, one of the main things that differentiates Indo-Iranian from other languages is they actually merge all of these non-high vowels. So all of these become A.
So they have a three-vowel system?
Yeah.
Or other six vowels?
Well, they develop other... So, like, in Sanskrit, you do have E and you do have O, but those actually develop from Indo-European diphthongs. So you actually still have these sounds, they're just, it's sort of like a chain shift or something like that. So all of these become A, and then, like, these sort of high-mid things become the mid-vowels. So in Sanskrit, like, so if you're familiar with the Devanagari writing system or whatever, so, like, you know, you have, like, E or something like that, so that's E. And then, like, you put a dash on it, and it's, like, I or something like that. Maybe it's vice versa. I don't remember. But,
yeah.
So, but there's a... So anyway, so the original idea had been that Sanskrit and early Indo-Iranian were sort of the, you know, were the original Indo-European languages, but there are a lot of respects in which they're not even the most conservative. Greek is actually a lot more conservative in vowels, and it's really, people sort of had a very primitive view of linguistic change back then, so it's not, anyway, things are different, that's all I was going to say. And of course, when nationalists read about Indo-European shit, you have all these people saying, you know, who are from this particular neighborhood in Bavaria, and of course they say, oh, Indo-Europeans must have come from my neighborhood in Bavaria, or whatever. So you have a bunch of shit like that. And I was actually over the break, one of the things I did, I was just bored, so I was watching a bunch of YouTube videos, some of which were Indo-European related. There's not very much good shit on Indo-European on YouTube, but if you go to any video and you just scroll down to the comments, you will see a national shit fest of, you know, especially
like a Michael Jackson music video, number one.
You got me there, but no, you just go to, and it's funny because you'll always see the same posters. It's like this one Romanian guy goes to every single video and posts the same shit about how Latin actually comes from Romanian, and in fact, all Indo-European languages. Exactly. So, that's just life, guys. So anyway, the Kurgan hypothesis. So the Kurgan hypothesis actually comes from the work of Maria Gimbutas, and she was an archaeologist back in the last century. She might still be alive, I'm not totally sure. So she was primarily an archaeologist. I think she did some linguistic work. But she has sort of coined the consensus view that Indo-Europeans, actually I should probably draw a map because we're going to be using a lot of maps today. So her idea was that Indo-Europeans come from the Pontic steppes, this area. Draw. There's Spain, there's Italy, there's Greece, Anatolia, Normandy, it's not so important. Persian Gulf. There's not much I can do anyway. I'll have to add some geological. So here's like, here are the Himalayas.
There they are.
Okay, this is really important. So here's like the Gobi Desert, I guess, around here. Here's the Tarim Basin. That's important for.
Oh, that's the what's it is?
The Tocharian. And there's not much out here. Oh yeah, I gotta draw.
There's the Black Sea or whatever.
I should have drawn this Black Sea way bigger. Okay, so it's more like that. So here's the Caspian Aral, which doesn't exist anymore, of course. But, that looks good enough. Okay. So way up in. Why did I sit down? I guess it's not way up here. So in the Pontic Steppes, which is right over here, you have these little things that are called Kurgans. In their little humps.
That's modern Ukraine, right?
Yeah, Ukraine, Russia, different parts. So there's this burial mound culture that is around 4,000, traced back to around 4,000 BC. And Gimbutas identifies Indo-European with this culture. It's generally known as the Yamna culture, or the Yamna culture is a little to the west. But the idea is there's this steppe culture, which Indo-Europeans seem to spread out. We'll go through sort of the data for this later on, or at least the circumstantial information. So her original idea, the note about the shitlords pertains to this. So Gimbutas had these sort of strange, I mean, she's a fine archaeologist, but she had these sort of strange ideas about pre-Indo-European Europe. That is, basically her idea was, you know, all the indigenous people of Europe were these peace-loving, matriarchal people with no violence, and why did she think this? It's not totally sure. It was just part of her thing. And the Indo-European shitlords came in, and they basically just fucked the place up. In fact, they fucked the whole world up, and, you know, they have their horses and their whatever. And
horses and cheese.
Yeah, cheese.
Is there any circumstantial, or, I mean, support her idea of a peaceful
depends on how circumstantial you want to be.
I mean, are there, like, no
swords
found of 4,000 BC?
Well, yeah, part of it is a lack of evidence. So part of it, she wants to say, oh, well, you don't find bodies strewn up all over the place. Of course, you don't find that in other places either. But, you know, okay, well, this is kind of the attitude at the time. There is a culture of sort of goddess idols or something like that. So you find, like, fertility statues, you know, big fat women with huge breasts and stuff that are, you know, just really round and stuff. And, you know, with the attitude back in the 60s, you find these kind of things, and you see patterns and you draw conclusions. I think I note here a similar thing actually happened with Minoan civilization. So you have this sort of pre-Indo-European civilization in, you know, Minoa or Crete, whatever. You know, people just sort of thought, you know, it's a beautiful matriarchal society. I mean, it was the zeitgeist of the time. It's just called zeitgeist. It was the zeitgeist back then. People have moved away from that, but her archaeological evidence or statement is still sort of out there. Now, linguistically, there's a good reason to think that Indo-Europeans originated somewhere in Eastern Europe, but sort of this area. And it's sort of, so are you guys familiar with, like, Austronesian languages? So the gist, you know, for those who don't know, you know, Polynesian and Austronesian, well, Austronesian is the big family, Polynesian's a subfamily, and then Malagasy, which is spoken in Madagascar, all of those are related to some kind of seafaring culture that originated relatively recently. They originate apparently from Taiwan. And the reason we know this is because there's basically one macro family. Well, there are a bunch of subfamilies. Mm-hmm. And one of these subfamilies expands all over the place, from Madagascar to all of Polynesia. Mm-hmm. And then all the other subfamilies are all in Taiwan. So the best, you know, explanation of that is where you have more linguistic diversity, that's probably where the language family originated, and you had one population that left and dispersed. So it's the same thing, basically. Well, again, this is circumstantial, but it's the same intuitions with Indo-European. So out in India, you really have one macro family. You have Indo-Iranian, and Iranian and Indic are both spread over all over the place. Over here, you have the families we talked about, so, you know, the ones everyone knows. You have Celtic, Italic, Baltic, Slavic. You also have some we haven't talked about that are sort of poorly attested, so like Illyrian or Thracian or these dialects. You have a bunch of languages sort of in Eastern Europe and, you know, the steppe area that are, you know, sort of all over the place. So it seems to be at least linguistic circumstantial evidence for an origin point sort of in this area. So Gimbutas, I actually note this here. So Gimbutas is like, old Europe, sort of her idea of, you know, the feminist pre-Proto-Indo-Europeans. You actually see this in stuff like the Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code is partially based on this. So the gist of that is, like, you know, there's this sort of cataclysmic battle between, you know, the paleo cult, the feminist paleo culture of Europe, and, you know, I know. You can read the Da Vinci Code.
That's fighting patriarchal Indo-European shit.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, that's just a side note.
That should be our
yeah, <that'd be> really good. That would be a good one. Yeah. And as I go through this, so everything else I say here is sort of predicated on the idea of the Kurgan hypothesis. Yeah. And there's no, like, one reason I can give you that it's right or wrong. It just matches with all of the sort of circumstantial evidence in a way other hypotheses don't.
The other stuff, I mean, you know more than I about this, but about the vocabulary, there's certain names for trees you only find there, and, like, you know.
Yeah. There are tree names. There are, of course, animal names.
Like honey or something like that.
Yeah, wheels and axles and stuff. And those originate, at least spread out from that area. There's a bunch of stuff like that. A lot of the specific, I'm not super specific with a lot of the tree names and plant names, but a lot of that is subject to semantic shift anyway, so it's not 100% sure how secure that is. But one of, we'll talk about the out of Anatolia hypothesis. One of the reasons that that's probably wrong is that Anatolian languages, you know, keep in mind, they're the first ones that move out of the, you know, whatever the speech community is. Those seem to, I should probably explain what the Anatoly idea is. So the Kurgan hypothesis basically has the idea that Indo-Europeans were pastoralists. So they raise horse and sheep and stuff like this, and they gradually expanded. They didn't necessarily have cities. They weren't necessarily sedimentary. The out of Anatolia hypothesis is a little different because it's not just geographically different. The idea there is that Indo-Europeans were farmer culture, and they spread with agriculture out of Anatolia several thousand years beforehand, or before the Kurgan hypothesis. So the reason I think this is wrong, the out of Anatolia theory, is because Anatolian languages actually borrow farming terminology from other languages. That's not in common with other Indo-European languages. So it seems clear to me that you have a totally separate culture, and then agriculture, or at least culturally, moves into the Indo-European speaking areas, and they borrow those terms. And then later they expand. They have no connection with the farming cultures at all. At least to me, it seems like. So I think I note here, I actually learned this over the break because I was reading about this. The idea intuitively is that, Indo-Europeans were associated with horses. They moved with horse domestication. So they must be riding them and stuff. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at if you dissect their dead bodies, you find that horses were actually one of the main meats that Indo-European people ate. It's not totally clear when they started riding them. It's not even totally clear when they're domesticated. So people will usually look at, if you have a horse mouth or whatever, that's a horse. There's his mouth. So you put this little thing in its mouth so you can ride it or whatever, steer it. So that's how you know if they're domesticated or not, if they have this little bit hole in their teeth. That originates around the period. And I think I noticed, I brought this up at some other day, but Indo-Europeans also apparently, genetically speaking, they move with lactose tolerance. So this originates about the same period, and there's a decent, I think it was by Cochrane and Harpending, they did the math, and if you're a pastoralist and you can digest lactose, you can get about five times as many calories from a set acre if you can drink an animal's milk rather than just raise an animal. So it's a huge advantage in terms of if you're a pastoralist, if you can actually eat or drink the animal's milk or whatever. So
when you're saying the Indo-Europeans were associated with horses, is the horse meat thing the only clue we have, or do we have other evidence?
Well, horse domestication, horses, of course, were native to the area at the time.
And the area you mean?
The steppes. So, and additionally, horses spread out, I probably should have made this explicit, horse domestication spreads out basically with Indo-Europeans at the same period. So you have horses moving into the Near East and stuff. We're about the time we expect Indo-Europeans to be moving around.
So how do we know when the Indo-Europeans were in which part of the world? Do
well,
we have
it's
fossils or?
Yeah, it's sort of a conspiracy of evidence. So we have the Yamna culture, the Kurgan culture, sort of at the same period. We have the horses, and it matches. Again, the linguistic data doesn't give us dates, but it's circumstantially similar. Later, maybe around 1,000 years later, you have a corded ware culture a little to the west, which is sort of thought of as being the homeland of Indo-European people in Europe. And you just have, it's sort of a symphony of different archaeological cultures that move in the right directions and that have the right sort of material cultures to, suggest the movement out of here.
So we look at the objects that were buried in these archaeological sites and match them with people there. And we conclude that this culture was in this part of the world at this time.
Yeah, and it's sort of circumstantial, obviously. But if you get a culture that's at a reasonable enough time, if you have a material culture that's moving in a way that you expect a language family to, it's not 100% proof, but it's good evidence of that. I think I note on the next page, in Europe. So in Europe, you have something called the corded ware culture. So people would basically make pots with, you know, they have this very distinctive corded decoration to it. And, you know, these are people sort of to the west edge of the Yamna culture. And they expand sort of with throughout Europe. You have later cultures. You have one called the Hallstatt culture. That's not worth writing. And that's generally associated with Proto-Celtic. You have, I forget the name of it, the Jastorf culture, which is southern Scandinavia. That's associated with the movement of Germanic people. All of these little cultures are sort of at the right time and the right place to coincide with some sort of linguistic movement. So it's circumstantial, but it's sort of the best narrative we have to cast over what we're seeing. But if you ask me, I mean, I think that the Kurgan hypothesis is, you know, the most strong of all hypotheses, but it could conceivably relate, you know, this data with some other culture or relate the Indo-Europeans to some other culture. But let's see. Oh, and so, okay, out of Anatolia. So there are good arguments for it and bad arguments for it. The good arguments for it, the okay arguments for it. Colin Renfrew is probably the one archaeologist who's most associated with this. I think he might be the only guy who still believes in out of Anatolia. But his idea is basically you have the, you know, agriculture around, you know, 8,000 BC or something, spreading out from Anatolia. Indo-Europeans actually move into the Baltic. And by the time Maria Gimbutas wants them to be in the Kurgan culture, they actually are there. So it's sort of a way of accommodating. His views have changed all the time, sort of to account for the data. And there's nothing terribly wrong with it. It's just a little more ad hoc, if you ask me. And again, the Anatolians have different words for agricultural stuff, so that's another problem. So that's that. Oh, and the bad arguments for him, as I mentioned to Ryan, you know, there are these, Quentin Atkinson and a bunch of other assholes have this stupid, just absolutely stupid, Martin Lewis has this really good presentation on YouTube, just like tearing it apart, because it's just so, I mean, see, this is the problem with scientists nowadays, they just take all their epistemological concerns and just let a computer deal with them. You just throw a bunch of words in a computer, it gives you fucking numbers, and you think that's science. That's not how it fucking works. Anyway, I don't want to talk about this. But there are people who do Bayesian blah, 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 and, you know, they find a bunch of shit because it's a bunch of bullshit. So anyway, so what? One of the more, of course, to Gimbutas, you know, Indo-European expansion was a shitlord invasion. So you actually have people on horses coming through and killing people or whatever. That obviously is, I mean, first off, Indo-Europeans do not move as one set people. That's very clear. I mean, basically all of early European history is, you know, Indo-Europeans killing other Indo-Europeans or something like that. There's no collective unity to them in the first place. It's also not very clear that there's any kind of mass shift in genetics in Europe at the time. In fact, it's, we'll talk about that when we get to the side. See, I put everything in a section and I don't follow it. One of the issues is how did Indo-Europeans expand? Did they invade? Did they conquer people, just genocide everyone and move in? Did they migrate? Was it just gradual cultural diffusion? That's also, I mean, it's an interesting intellectual question, I guess. But it's also sort of one of those politically tinged things, just because, especially in India, where there's still a relationship between Indo-European people and sort of pre-Indo-European people, there's sort of politics behind that. So the earliest we have, the correct answer to this is it's different in different cultures. So if you look at the Near East, So if you look at the Near East, you have the during the Bronze Age, you have the Hittites, and of course in Anatolia, you have.
The European part of it's pretty good.
Well, there's not much to draw out of here. I mean, it's all land. I mean, what am I supposed to do?
Sure.
Anyway, okay, so you have the Hittites, you have a people called the Mitanni, and you have the Kassites. So, of course...
excuse my ignorance. So when you say the Bronze Age, that's when?
3000-ish BC, or maybe a little... Or no, after that, maybe around 2000 BC and onward. So of course, originally in the Fertile Crescent, you had people called Hurrians, you had Sumerians and different cultures. So Sumerian is apparently a language isolate. Hurrian is probably also one. These are the indigenous people to the Middle East before Indo-Europeans or Semitic people come in. First you have, before these, you have really the world's first empire, the Akkadian Empire, where Sargon goes around conquering all the Sumerian city-states and putting them under. Of course, he was he spoke Akkadian, which is Semitic, but you still have a long period of people who, spoke the native Hurrian or Sumerian dialects. Gradually, the Akkadian and Assyrian empires collapse. What you have is, you have Babylonia, which becomes ruled by people called the Kassites. Then you have the Mitanni, who are ruled by a nameless ruling class, and then you have the Hittites. So in all three of these cases, you see the same things. You see a ruling class which is nearly definitely Indo-European. Mm-hmm. So in the case of the Mitanni, we don't know the name of their ruling class, but it's very obvious that they're Indo-European. In fact, they speak manifestly an Indic language, because you can actually look at the names for their gods. You have stuff like Mithra and Varuna and stuff like this. You also have phonetic changes, which are indicative of specifically Indic families as opposed to Iranian ones. The same seems to be true of the Kassites. It's not 100% sure if the Kassites were Indo-European, but there's circumstantial evidence to think they are. And in the case of the Hittites, so the word Hittite, for those who don't know, it actually comes from the Bible. The people we are, the Indo-European people we call the Hittites, would not call themselves like the Hittites or anything else. I think they were called something like the Nesha or Nessa. Now, the native people who the Hittites conquered were called the Hattians, or their empire was focused in Hatti, which is a city in the region. And we call them Hittites because that's what they're called in the Bible, and people weren't really sure what to call them. But here, the same thing is true. So you have the native Hattian population, who I think spoke Hurrian language, and the Hittites imposed themselves as a ruling class. So what I was trying to say is, in the Near East, Indo-Europeans move in, and they don't necessarily move in and populate the area, but you just have sort of an elite conquering the place and ruling the place. And, of course, Indo-European languages never become really significant in the Fertile Crescent. You sort of have that happening in Anatolia. Gradually, Anatolian languages take over, like Lydian and Hittite and Luwian and stuff like that. So that's what you have in the Near East. And the same seems to be true generally in India. Now, obviously, as I said, India has this caste system, which is a very this is very... context for this. Obviously, after the post-colonial period, people were really raw about British colonialism, so the idea was everything bad must have been British, so the caste system is bad, therefore the British must have made the caste system up. So there's a lot of sort of, in a lot of senses, a lot of the particulars of the caste system were sort of systematized by the British, but of course, culturally speaking, it had been there for thousands of years beforehand. And there's been very interesting work done in the genetics of Indian people. So, of course, generally, people of North India tend to have more similarities with people outside of India, while the indigenous population is localized in the south. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be two major movements into India in recent times. You have a native population that goes back to the Holocene, back, 50,000 BC, people who had been indigenous to the continent for a long time. Then you have the movement of the Dravidian people, which, of course, are the main languages of the south.
Yeah.
They're not actually very indigenous to India. They only precede Indo-Europeans by a couple thousand years. And it appears, two things. One, it appears that they bring agriculture to India. Before that, apparently the natives were hunter-gatherers. And secondly,
They genetically speaking, they're very closely related to Georgians of all people, or people in the Caucasus and stuff like that. So there's some, and there's probably been someone who suggested that they're related to Caucasus languages. I don't know the particulars. But yeah, that's that. And then later you have the Indo-Europeans move in nearly directly after, and somehow impose themselves as a ruling class, partially embedded in the caste system, stuff like that. So it used to be, there used to be the idea that Indo-Europeans came in and, of course, shitlorded everyone. There are some famous sites like Mohenjo-Daro, which is in Pakistan, where you have this sort of pre-Indo-European, probably Dravidian culture, that had their own, cities and agriculture and stuff like that. And, there was just sort of an archaeological debate, was this destroyed by, horse riders or, well, I don't know. It's, the sort of consensus on it is that there was not necessarily an invasion. There might have been some kind of, we really just don't know. It's like I said, so much of this shit is just circumstantial. So that's bad enough of that.
Sorry, the Dravidians of India, do they share the same religion and the caste system?
They are part of the caste system, and I suppose most of them practice what we call Hinduism, but then again, Hinduism is a very wide... I mean, Hinduism really just means the religions of India, which are not necessarily uniform. So I'm sure that there are cultural differences, but I...
So, like, I am under the impression that generally the Hindu religions are, related to their ancestor Indo-European.
Hinduism Indo-European.
Yeah.
So I'm asking to see how the Dravidian religious system is.
I could not answer that. You're right. A lot of the Hindu pantheon comes from Indo-European, figureheads. But I don't know how it differs with Dravidian people. Mm-hmm. Be worth looking into. So 2.2. So Europe is a little different genetically because there's not necessarily a substrate of pre-Indo-European people. the reason that is probably, just historically, even in written history, you have a constant stream of people always coming into Europe. Every 100 years someone invades and, fucks everyone. So the genetics between Europeans and steppe people is really small. And that seems to be why there's no huge difference between Indo-Europeans and the quote-unquote indigenous people of Europe. Even situations like the Basque, the Basques are nearly genetically identical to Europeans. Really, the only difference between Basques and the other Europeans is that Basques have less admixture from people who came later, like the Moors, or people from African populations that came after Indo-Europeans. So there's not a huge difference genetically in Indo-European people. And I sort of talked about all this before. So you have a huge diversity of different families in Eastern Europe. That's, again, circumstantial evidence for, the origin of Indo-European families around there. You have the Corduidwer culture, Hallstatt culture, Jastorf culture. All of those are tied to sort of movements of Indo-European people. But it's super circumstantial, as everything is. Any smart comments?
Smart ones?
No. Dumb ones? Yeah. All right. So, Tarim Basin. So the Tukarians, I was reading on the Tukarians over the break. They're very interesting people. Nothing known about them. And they shouldn't be called the Tukarians.
Where does that name come from?
It comes, I think I say it on the next... Maybe I don't. I don't think
those were pot smoking Buddhists.
Oh yeah, that is correct. Okay, well I don't. The word Tocharian I think is an exonym for actually a Bactrian people. So the Greeks would call Bactrian people something like related to the word Tocharian. Bactrian people were Iranian though, so it's sort of. I mean, out where in the Tarim Basin, so you have the Tocharians who sort of, lived around this rim. And you have Iranian people just all over the place, and so people got them confused a lot. There were periods where Tocharians ruled Iranians, probably the other way around. So it, and of course, this is, this area is also pretty well attested by Chinese historians. So it's sort of a problem of, okay, well, what people in the Chinese record correspond to, you know, Iranian people we know of from the Greek record or, you know, Persian records or something like that. Anyway, so Tocharians, we don't have Tocharian attested until pretty recently, as in, you know, maybe 1000 AD or something like that. But based on the language, it's very clear that it diverged extremely early. And I list some of the weird things Tocharian has. Tocharian is a good example of a language which has a lot of contact with Turkic languages. So it's actually lost most of the Indo-European oblique cases, so it loses ablative and all that stuff. And it actually grammaticalizes new cases. So like it actually gets a new ablative from a postposition, you know, it has an allative, a couple weird things, committative. I don't even know what a paralative is, but, you know, it was in the book, so, you know, I put that there. So all of these are grammatical. All of these are totally regular endings. They're not like Indo-European where you have a different ending for a different declension or different singular plural. All of them are the same. They're all grammaticalized from postpositions.
I think a paralative might be like through.
That's what I was suspecting. Yeah. You never know, though. So what? One of the corollaries of this is the second dot, which is group inflection, which isn't a good English pronunciation of that word. So that's when, obviously, there's the... so let's say that I'm sitting in a room, you know, with Ryan and Mosen. So if I spoke, you know, a normal Indo-European language, if I wanted to mark these with, like, instrumental or something to say I'm with them, you know, I'd put, like, you know, Ryan with, Mosen with, and that would be it. But Tocharian has what's called group inflection, which is where you treat this case marker as a postposition. And so you don't put one on Ryan, you just say Ryan Mosen with, something like that. So it's sort of a halfway between a postposition and an inflection, or it might just be totally a postposition. We just classify these as inflections, because why the hell not? So Tocharian has that in its innovated cases. And phonetically, this is really weird, you totally lose the differences between different stop series in Proto-Indo-European. So P and B and P all become P in Tocharian. Same thing with T's and K's and everything else. So all the distinctions between VOT are totally lost in Tocharian. And I don't think I put it here, but there are two Tocharian dialects, Tocharian A and Tocharian B. People say a bunch of stuff about them, but no one... Okay, so people sometimes say that A is a liturgical language. What the real case is that A is... It just happened to be that all the texts we have in A are religious. It's just a coincidence. B is actually the more conservative dialect, and there are... they both grammaticalize different cases. They both have different phonological changes. We're not totally sure if they're mutually intelligible. I do not actually know that. I don't know that at all. Never really thought about it. I guess Latin script. I mean, I have no clue. Yeah, someone look that up.
My phone's crashed already. As far as we know, this language is not related to any of the other European languages.
Yeah, it's very distinct from all other families. That's why I said it's nearly sure it's one of the first to diverge.
So this is what the Tocharian script looked like.
Oh, they had their own script.
They had their own script.
Oh, well, that...
So it descends from the Phoenician alphabet.
Oh. But it goes through Brahmi. Okay.
Yeah, Brahmi.
Oh, yeah, well, that would make sense. So, Tocharians clearly borrow a lot of terms from Sanskrit. Mostly religious terms, because they were pot-smoking Buddhists, I say to you. I put pot-smoking because famously there was this Tocharian grave found with something like 7 kilograms of marijuana in it or something like that. It was something insane. So,
gotta do it.
So they were pot-smoking Buddhists, and they were pretty essential to spreading Buddhism to China.
I've I also thought the same thing, and I looked it up a few weeks ago and was surprised to discover that it originates in, I think, like, Iran or something.
Oh, man.
Freaking smuggling opium and
opium is like opium. The thing.
Opium's like Iran's chief export. Thank God we have a trade agreement.
Come on, it's Afghanistan's chief
export. Yeah.
It's our chief import, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
No, Jesus.
From Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. What are they talking about? Otakarians.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and famously, there are these things called the Tarim mummies, which are related to Tartarians. And they're interesting because they're genetically distinct from the Turkic people around. They have very clearly Caucasoid bone structure and slightly lighter features. So those are generally related to Indo-Europeans, although not always. Again, you know, unlike previous nationalist theories, Indo-Europeans were not a bunch of blonde-haired, blue-eyes, master race kind of people. They're religious to whoever, although the movement of things like eye color, particularly blue eyes, originate at some period, maybe at the Baltic Sea, maybe a little before Indo-Europeans arrive. And it appears at least Tocharians sort of move those phenotypes out east. Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's not like, it's just one of those things. I mean, Indo-Europeans were not, it was a phenotype of Europe, and it happened to be moved out by some Indo-European people, but it's not specifically linkable to them as opposed to other people. To my understandings, actually, blue eyes were pretty common in Europe even before light skin was. So you had, I think the natives of Britain were sort of dark-skinned, and they had lighter eyes or something like that.
Was there an evolutionary advantage?
I was wondering.
I've heard it's sexual selection, but you could say that about anything, and I'm not entirely sure. You never, I mean, you can make a story.
Read the comments on YouTube. People are into weird shit.
Yeah. No doubt.
I'm totally convinced you got me. I mean...
Well, you should have a conversation with Massimo about that.
Oh, yeah.
You'll learn that nothing is selected for.
Yes. What is selected for? That's what whole fucking book is about.
Yeah.
What Darwin got wrong. Yeah. It's all about what does selected for mean. It is empty.
Just asking.
It is an empty note.
Yes.
Yeah.
You see, Massimo. Ooh.
Yeah, the Fodor and Massimo bullshit.
Yep.
Should talk to Andy Wadham about it.
Yeah. That'd be fun.
I've talked to him about
it.
Yeah, he was actually pretty calm about it generally, but he was mostly miffed that, like, they sent him a draft of it. He was like, no, this is not how it even works. And Massimo was like, meh, and he just rolled with it. So he was mostly just like upset that he didn't take any of his comments into consideration.
Is this a book they're publishing, or
it's been published? You can read it in the library.
Yeah, it's been on.
What Darwin got wrong.
I mean, it's mostly just in a sort of a rebuttal of sort of pop understandings of biology. I mean, to them, that this is probably why Andy's so pissed at it, because they present it as being like a huge flaw in the field, but it's like, it's just based on sort of pop Darwinism, where like, oh, every little, you know, social thing evolved as some kind of, you know, something beneficial.
Yeah.
Like, things don't like, just, shit doesn't just happen.
Like, adaptationism.
Yeah.
So, well...
The correct answer is who knows. I mean, you can make a bunch of. I mean, it's the same thing as where exactly the Indo-Europeans come from. It's a competition between what narrative is most plausible. Mm-hmm. And in the case of blue eyes, I'm not 100% sure.
So we don't know for a fact that at least some evolutionary features were selected because of giving an advantage.
Well, it's just everything is aggregated, so it's it's hard to make. I mean, when you have a whole genome and you have one little change, I think the point that Massimo's trying to make is that when you have a whole genome and one little change, you're not going to have selection for that particular thing, and it's hard to.
Sexual or artificial selection.
Yeah, or even if you have a population which has a whole bunch of diversity, the differences between two different people are not just one gene switching. Like, there are lots of different things that are being selected at any given time. And it's just hard to say. It's just a lot of our metaphors for addressing evolution are insufficient. That's part of what boils down to.
I'm not sure if I understood it better.
It doesn't make much sense. It's sort of an... He's making sort of an arcane point about it.
The genes that control blue eyes, there's so much other shit going on in that. You don't know if it's just the blue eyes.
Well, okay. Yeah, that just means that some features.
I mean,
the claim that no feature got through because of that is even bigger than the claim that all features got through because of that.
Well, keep in mind, it's written by a philosopher in Massimo, so.
That's, there you go.
Well, there. So, yeah.
I mean, some of those. So you do have, like, gradualist adaptationist accounts of, say, language development. And you also have something that's at least somewhat plausible, like these kind of... Well, some people call them, like, spandrel accounts, but you have these kinds of cases where some trait is selected for some reason, and then something that developed for some other reason, like, changed into something else, or developed kind of on top of that. It wasn't directly selected for, but it came about through some other means. Because something that it was related to was selected for directly. So you have these kind of indirect adaptations to cats. That makes some sense. And then you have, like, the general laws of the universe stuff. You know, that's kind of...
Yeah.
Depending on who it is, it can be kind of goofy.
I don't think any evolutionary biologist just comes out and say that, like, okay, all features that you see in...
It's a straw man. I mean,
it is a huge straw man.
It's mostly against sort of, again, like pop biology, where people say, oh, you know, why you have earlobes? Oh, because, you know, it has some, you make up some story about people on the steps. Yeah,
it's like a just so story.
Yeah. So a lot of it's just keep your mouth shut about this. And again, I don't necessarily think, again, they are straw manning things. It's not really how the field works, but, you know. That's Massimo. Anyway.
Iranian people.
Hey. Oh, the boring part. Oh, why did I even put this here? So, Iranian people, ignoring bizarre exceptions like the Persians, are the most nomadic Indo-European group. So, keep in mind that all of the Urmheimat, or whatever the hell it is, all of the native area of Indo-Europeans is, for most of history, is populated by Iranians. So, you really have this massive... All this shit is basically just Iranian. So you have it's not just one population. You have lots of little tribes that have sort of been, we know by one or two names, and we don't know which one's which, and we don't know if some of them are the same one, blah, 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 your typical stuff in prehistory. So, of course, the Persians and stuff like that, some populations gradually move into the, what we now call Iran, and, you know, leave the pastoral lifestyle. Of course, there's that famous, I guess it was from the life of Cyrus, where, Cyrus has his capital up in, you know, the mountains or whatever, and someone's like, hey, we should move down to the Fertile Crescent, because it's, you know, nice, and, you know, you can grow a bunch of shit, and he says something like, if soft lands make soft people, and hard lands make hard people, or something like that. Like, so we should stay up here where it's, you know, inhospitable or some shit. So that's why Pasargadae is up, you know, in the middle of nowhere or wherever. That's why the Persians didn't move down to Babylon.
Yeah, that's why we ended up like this.
Yeah.
So is there a region that is associated with the Proto-Indo-Iranian group before they diverged into two distinct populations?
I don't feel like there is. There are some material cultures I know up here that are associated with the Tocharians, which I think might have had Iranian people in them for periods. But I don't think there's one material culture that unifies Indic and Iranian people. At least not to my knowledge. There probably is one that I just...
But linguistically, they do seem to be...
They're very close, which is a little weird. So as I said, so you have...
Even from the religious point of view,
yeah,
they seem to be descended from one population that used to live together before.
Yeah. And even stuff like Avestan, you know, Avestan is nearly Sanskrit and stuff like this. They're very close. What seems, you probably had them in some kind of dialect continuum for prolonged periods. So you probably had some kind of Satim language dialect continuum out in the area. As I said, the Mitanni spoke an Indic language. So you had Indic people all the way out here, and they might have been in communion with Iranians or something. It's just, we don't know the specifics.
And are these the only Satim languages?
Like Baltic and Slavic are Satim as well.
Oh, okay.
That's,
yeah, and where do they fit into this map? I don't see what, they are not accounted for.
Yeah, they are not accounted for, that's why. So Slavs only come into history relatively recently. They're probably still in this sort of dialect continuum out there, just unbeknownst to us.
So are there written records to ensure that, like, this whole area that is called Iranian languages doesn't, like, also contain Slavic and Baltic? Could we just say that this whole thing is Satem?
Well, the languages, the Baltic and Slavic are distinct enough from Indo-Iranian to say that that can't be the case.
Yeah.
So they have to be distinct enough. There has to be some distinct Baltic-Slavic area. Because a lot of, I guess I mentioned before you came in, Indo-Iranian has very significant sound changes, like they merge eh, o, and ah. It's a huge sound change that affects every fucking word. So you know which one's an Indo-Iranian language. And Baltic and Slavic can't be in there. It's hard to tell. But they have to be distinct in some way. So Iranians, I didn't even know this until over the break when I was reading into it, but the Alans, so has anyone heard of the Alans?
Yeah,
so these guys, for all my life, I thought they were Germanic people because, you know, you play video games and they're one of the people invading Europe in the fall of Rome or whatever. They're actually Iranian. In fact, the word comes from Aryan. You would have never thought. And they're crazy people because, you know, they help the Vandal invasion of North Africa, mm-hmm. and they live with them there. They lived in Spain for a period. They live in Georgia for a period. They live out on the steppes for a period. They're just all over like every century, they're somewhere else. And that's sort of the case with a lot of Iranian people. So you have all these cultures. So you have, like, the Saka. So I put the Saka, Scythians, and Sarmatians, who might actually all be the same group. We're not even sure. So these are, like, nomadic people. They had these very distinct, tall, red hats. They would have very decorated robes and stuff like that. And they're one of the cultures which were constantly biting at whatever, quote-unquote, civilized people were around them.
This is the Alans you're talking about?
The Saka and the Scythians and all those. So these are Iranian people who sort of might have been a more uniform culture out on the steppes. It's not totally clear. In video games, there are just one civilization, so, I mean, I guess they're, well, you know.
Trust the video
games. Yeah, trust the video games. That's where I know anything about history.
The ancient sources call them all one people, too. But
yeah.
The ancient sources are often wrong.
Yeah, so you never know. And you also have the Sogdians, who are out closer to Tokarians. I put here, I also didn't know this, so Amlushan was a Sogdian. I totally didn't know this. So at the end of the Tang Dynasty, there was this huge revolt, which famously allegedly killed, two-thirds of the population of China. Just everyone was dying or displaced, caused by a Sogdian. So this guy was trying to overthrow the government. And fun fact for you. Yeah, most of the steppe languages, I think, are Eastern Iranian. And then,
Do you know where the Median language fits in?
I think it's pretty closely related to Persian. I think, I'm not 100% sure.
It's the Western language?
Yeah, I think so. I think most of the people... Okay, do you know where Kurds are? Are they what? Are
they're,
they Western?
They're West South.
Okay,
Turkey,
that's what I thought. Well, I meant language family. I feel
they're
like
Northwestern.
Are they? Well, I, f- I feel like most of the nomadic people are classified as having Eastern languages. I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, no, definitely not the Kurds. Like, okay. Kurdish is definitely Western.
Okay, okay.
I'm not sure about South or North, but it's definitely Western Iranian.
Well, I'm not as familiar. Well, in my classification, I guess the way I was taught it was there was just West and East, so I can't distinguish between those.
Baluchi is also Western Iranian.
Is it?
Even though it's...
geographically,
yeah,
I don't know. To be honest, I'm not totally sure how everyone moved around, so I don't even know where the terms come from. And then I think Avestan is sort of between the two families or something like that.
So yeah, they call them West and East based on the distinction between, like, the changes that appeared in Old Persian.
Yeah.
They called those changes like West Persian. West Iranian changes, and then any language that has those is considered Western.
So everything, so East is just like the elsewhere condition or something?
Yeah. And then,
that's weird.
And it happens to match the geographic distinction to some extent, but then you have cases like Balochi that really don't make any sense.
Yeah. Where all the languages outside of Iran, I guess. But of course, all the steppe people, all the Sakha and whatever, they're eventually replaced by the Slavs and the Turks and stuff like that. Do you know anything about Parthian?
Yeah, it's
west or east?
It's west. It's very close to Persian.
Okay.
So until recently, meaning like 80 years ago, people thought Parthian and Persian are just dialects of the same language, but now they believe them to be different languages. So some of the Pahlavi works are actually Parthian, not Persian.
Don't know. But do you know anything about the Gathas? Like,
it depends what you mean by anything.
Well, there's just debate because, you know, it's unclear whether they were written when, you know, whether the authors were actually pastoralists, or if they had settled down, or something like that. I think there are a lot of people who say at least the distinction between Iranian and Indian languages, or the peoples, is predicated on some kind of religious distinction. So that might have been important to that. But I was just curious if you know anything about them.
Well, I know the religious distinction was, so apparently the Indian side, like, the Proto-Indo-Iranian population had this set of gods that were divided into two major sets.
Yeah.
And then the, like, Zoroastrian tradition was to get rid of one of them and call them, like, evil.
Yeah.
So the Persian were Div, which is related to Dio and Zeus and all those things. It actually means evil in Persian. As opposed to all the other languages.
I didn't know that. Yep. Any other comments? So Iranian people also invade India. That's the Kushan Empire.
When is that?
I think it's in the Common Era at some period. I'm trying to think exactly what year. I'll just look it up. I think it was maybe around 500 or something like that. And those were people who, I think, were historically subordinate to the Tocharians or something like that.
Third century AD. Short-lived, fell to the Sasanians pretty quickly.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. Is there anything else to say about migration of people or
migration
just general?
Have you seen Highlander?
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Missing some culture in this room.
Okay, next session.
Yeah, so what do you guys want to do?
Have you seen the sequels?
I've seen one of them.
Like in the coming
session. Oh, that's the one where they're all aliens.
Oh, that one doesn't count. That one literally doesn't count. Like, they made the third one and they both pretended it never existed.
Yeah. Sorry, what? But,
we were talking about what we're going to do. Masin was going to give suggestions.
No, I wasn't going to give suggestions. I was going to tell you what I really like. So I like to become familiar with some of these languages in some detail. Like either classical Latin, but that's a little difficult because you all know some Latin. I know nothing.
Can I make a recommendation or a suggestion or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah.
I mean, kind of what we were supposed to do in typology. We'll all pick a pet language, and then instead of having Luke come up here and talk the whole time, you talk about old Persian because you're interested in it, you know some shit. You can talk about Latin or whatever. You can talk about Quechua, I don't know.
That works.
Yeah. You know, we all right now say, all work on
I did a fair amount of, like, old Germanic languages in my undergrad, so old English and like old Saxon stuff. Yeah, so I can tell stuff about.
It is
Germanic.
A suggestion.
Yeah, I like your suggestion.
Yeah, let's
that's a good one.
Let's do that.
Let's do that.
Good job, Ben.
So tell me, Luke, which one's better for me, old Persian or Avestan? Based on the resources available and.
I know Avestan's more popular. I mean, or more useful in terms of historical linguistics, but it depends on. I don't know what all is written in Old Persian. I think if there's like some interesting shit that you want to look into, you might want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
Okay, I'll pick one of them. I'll read some stuff and pick one of them.
Sounds good.
Any
Trevor?
Latin, right?
I guess I've been nominated, so sure. I already know lots of Latin.
Oh, he took the easy one. Damn it. Anyone else?
I know nothing about anything.
Really, I was going to pick one.
I can be whatever. I can just take something out of the hat, and I'll be equally good for that.
Yeah.
So,
even some Slavonic.
Yeah,
I was about to suggest it.
I took a class on OCS once. I could probably.
Oh, really?
Nice.
Oh,
shit. No, I took a class in Old Norse. I took it for a year.
Oh, that's a good one.
Well, there we go. Yeah.
So no one's doing Greek. I wanted to see some Greek. Okay.
I guess I can
saying,
do Greek.
Well, I mean, for my suggestion, it doesn't have to be only one. It doesn't have to be all at once. I don't know.
Yeah, I can do Greek. I can do Greek.
What was his? I didn't.
Old
Slavonic. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He said OCS.
Wow,
yeah,
OCS.
Hey, you're.
What about
Ron?
Not
even saying.
I offered up Germanic.
Oh.
I learned.
Well, I mean,
one year.
Well, he's doing like the oldest.
I could do something else. Like, I don't remember much of it. I just remember there's like.
Umlaut. Okay. Well, yeah.
Umlaut in like cases.
I can do like Old Norse and Old English and Saxon stuff. And you can throw stuff out there if you're like. Ah, I remember loads of Old Norse.
I remember reading all sorts of Eddas or sagas. And
so
just,
those are classics.
We can go each session.
Oh, wait,
we discuss one issue, either vocabulary or sound change or this particular syntactic feature, so that we can compare.
That's
cool.
Good idea.
Yeah,
we can. Well, okay. Where should we start? Anyone
like how long
sound system or
I think sound is a good place
sound
to start.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
So you want to do
like
sounds of language X, sounds of language Y, sounds of language Z.
Or
which is all we have sound
in general.
Yeah, like next week we all do the sound systems of our
now,
languages.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah.
So,
I've had Grimm's Law like just beaten in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just poop it out.
Yep.
Turn around and
go Grimm's Law.
So if you have resources, written resources.
I probably do.
Thank you.
Okay, so everyone's family, so you wanted to do either Avestan or Old Persian.
Italic.
And then you OCS.
Slavic.
And then you guys are doing some kind of Germanic.
I mean, I could do Celtic.
Yeah.
You're on the Celtic. Yeah, perfect.
Works out.
I wanted somebody to do that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I'll do
Greek.
Okay.
That's small.
Cool.
If there are multiple tell any language besides Greek.
As this?
So I have, when I figure out how to use the scanner, I will scan that old Christomathy of good old Jerry Klein's, and I will maybe send you guys each the particular pages from your languages, just because it's a good research resource. It has like
I have the Fortson book on PDF. Do you have that too?
I do have that on PDF. I can send that out, and everyone can sort of look through it. And there are resources out there. I think I'm trying to think. Well, it's your own journey.
You suffer from the Pen murder, right?
Yeah, I do.
Suffer.
I sure do. It's actually.
You also have pain or.
Pain?
Pain
merger.
I was just listing your sufferings.
No, but I was, I actually saw good old Jerry Klein over the break, and just randomly. And, I was like, we totally have this, I told him we have this Indo-European reading group, and he was so awkward, you know, he was so awkward about it, and he was like laughing like a little child. He was like, oh that's great. He was like, I told him, you know, I was using your Christomathy as a guide. You know, it's so useful. He's like, you'd have to meet him. Like, he's just a. He's a
So as this group progresses, do we want to start moving outside of Indo-European? Like, I know that you did some stuff. Like, you looked a little bit at Semitic, I think.
Yeah, I looked at Semitic and Afroasiatic. I think we should definitely do what we just said we're going to do, because I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Cool. But after that, we can probably... I mean, we could do the same thing with different of the world's like major language families and, you know, evaluate things
there
like...
There are no other major language
families. Well, I mean, there are ones that are definitely...
There's Indo-European, there's the rest.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, there's the Altaic language family.
Oh,
and
shut up.
Shut
the fuck up.
My favorite.
Well, I was telling Ryan, I finally looked into Diné and Yeniseian, which is, you know, so Diné is, not Diné is in Native America, and Yeniseian is this Central Siberian language, and I used to think it was total phooey, but like that they would be related, but there's some pretty compelling evidence that they're actually related. There are definitely, you know, there's Austronesian and Austronesian, Afroasiatic, Niger Congo. There are a bunch of. I don't know anything about a lot of these, but they might be interesting.
I would offer to do Japonic, which is, you know.
What languages are those?
More than you might realize. So.
Yeah.
Like, all the Ryukyuan languages too, which are infinitely more interesting than even Japanese. So. Mm. Which is itself interesting. Speaking of that, for people who are interested in field work, is supposed to be something happening in Anchorage, Alaska.
Oh, Kolang?
Yeah, they
have a Japanese language.
Yeah, they have Miyako, I believe is the language that they're investigating, which is a fascinating language in terms of morphology and in phonology. Like, it's basically the Japanese Berber. It's just like, what are vowels? Which is like the opposite of Japanese. It's like, I have to have vowels everywhere.
There are vowels here. Would you like a vowel? I would like to buy a vowel.
Leave,
all right. So everyone, do your sound system.
Send us resources.
Yeah, I will send you what resources I have, and I guess some notes on how to unify what we're gonna do.
Try to connect what I have with the Persian, because at least two people in this room know some Persian.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Let's start the task of erasing this shit.
I'll just leave it up. Fuck it.
No one's gonna know why.
No one's gonna.
Not that we won't know.
Who else is gonna talk about
a massive erasure.
So who's in the... Are you in historical wing?
Just you.
Who all is in there?
Like how many?
Yeah.
Ben.
Oh, Ben Martin.
Ben. Okay.
Jeremy, the senior undergrad linguistics major, two other people from, one I recognize from St. Texas, and one I
don't know.
Marion,
see you later.
What? Oh, yeah, she is.
And then Marion was sitting in on it.
Oh, man.
Who's sitting in on it?
I kind of want to sit on.
Oh, Maureen.
That sounds cool.
Wait, is there anyone who gives a shit about Indo-European there?
John.
Hopefully he gives a shit.
He doesn't really care.
He's just a poser.
Josh has studied a lot of German, it turns out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so her husband's Dutch?
Yeah, she's Dutch or something.
Yeah. I know she talks about Dutch a lot, about speaking Dutch at home.
Yeah.
And I don't think she's Dutch.
So. No, she's not.
Yeah. That's quite clear.
But,
you never know.
You know, she could be Natasha Barnes.
We did no linguistics today.
We did a lot of interesting stuff. So, I mean, it made me realize that there was some fun stuff back in archaeology, which I did a million years ago. So.